Welcome to STEM Spots, a weekly science review produced in cooperation with the Missouri State University Department of Physics, Astronomy, and Materials Science.
Hi, this is Dave Cornelison, and you're listening to the web version of STEM Spots. With me in the studio is Dr. Christopher Lupfer. He's an assistant professor of biology here at Missouri State University. Thanks for stopping by, Christopher.
Thanks for having me.
So, Christopher, you are an immunologist. I'm not sure exactly what that means in the context of a biology department. Tell me what it is that you do.
So I study how the immune system, or all of the white blood cells in your body, help to protect you from infection. It goes deeper than that, though, because we now understand that all of those white blood cells also help to fight cancer. They're involved in autoimmune diseases, everything from hay fever to multiple sclerosis. They're also involved in the way your brain functions. So we now know that things like autism even have to do with your immune system.
Now that's interesting, because then people think, okay, am I just stuck? I got my genetics and I'm just stuck with the immune system. Or, you know, for a while there, I don't know if you've read something like this, but for a while people were saying, you know, kids today, they're not in the dirt enough. And so their immune system is suppressed. So talk a little bit about how the immune system is sort of set up. Is it all genetics, or are there ways that it gets strengthened?
Right. So there are obviously genetic factors involved, and you know, certain autoimmune diseases have specific genetic mutations that are associated with them. And in those situations, unfortunately, you're just stuck. On the other hand, there is a lot of plasticity or movement in the immune system, and it can be trained to recognize certain things as being okay. So for example, what you eat typically teaches your immune system to ignore it. So if you eat something, your immune system then sees it as food and you shouldn't attack it, and it's normal, leave it alone. There can be things like the types of bacteria that live in your intestines are now understood to be very important for training your immune system. There's been a lot of research, and most of this happens in mice, just because doing research on humans is not only technically challenging, but also
fraught with ethical dilemmas.
Yeah, there you go, ethical dilemmas. But we can basically make what we call a germ-free mouse, where the mouse is born by sterile cesarean section and it has no viruses, no bacteria, nothing in it or on it. And the immune system in those mice never develops completely. So that tells us that the bacteria that help us digest our food and all of that actually teach our immune system how to behave itself. And there's a window of opportunity in a mouse. It's probably shorter than a human, but it's only 3 or 4 weeks in a mouse. And after those 3 or 4 weeks, even if you put all those good bacteria back, the immune system still never develops fully.
So what doesn't kill us makes us stronger? Is that true or not?
To a certain extent, there is a prevailing hypothesis called the hygiene hypothesis. And it's this idea that we live in such a sterile environment nowadays. We sterilize the baby bottle, we sterilize everything, and our immune systems never get exposed to the things that would teach them how to behave. And so they basically get bored and they start going after things like pollen, which is harmless.
Well, I mean, that's interesting because, as you know, I'm a little older than you are, but certainly when I was young, we played outside all the time and dug in the dirt constantly. I was always digging things up of various kinds. Anthills was probably the number one thing, but then whatever else I could get my hands on. And I would say, from having 4 children of my own, that kids, although mine spent quite a bit of time outside, that I would say it was significantly lower than the amount of time I spent. And my grandchild, I think, spends less time. Do you think people are exposing themselves to less stuff when they're young now, and that actually is probably not great?
I believe that that's correct. So there have been a couple of studies, and not just here in the United States, several in Europe and other countries, showing that even just having something like an indoor-outdoor dog as a child exposes you to more things, and you're less likely to develop allergies if you have a dog that's going to bring things in, and you're going to get it on your hands and you're going to eat it, and it's going to expose you to all those kind of natural things. Also, growing up in a rural area, like on a farm, you're less likely to get allergies just because you're exposed to the farm animals and all of those things.
Right. Now, the work you do, is it mostly, I think you're mostly a laboratory scientist. Is that correct?
That's correct. Most of what I do is in the lab.
And so what kinds of things would students do? Would they be handling cells, or what kinds of things would they learn?
So different students in my lab have projects that range anywhere from just human cells, understanding really how cells communicate, all the way up to using animals as a model for different types of infections.
Right. And so a lot of lab work, they get experience in that sort of thing. And then what do you think they do? Do most of them, I'm just curious, we didn't talk about this earlier, but would they go on to graduate work or would they go work in industry or what kinds of things might they do?
Most of my students have gone on to either do graduate work or continue working in an academic setting. So it could be as a lab technician in an academic lab.
Okay. Okay. Now let's talk about a specific project. You and I had already chatted a little bit about this idea of co-infections and the work you're doing in that. So take us through that.
So co-infection is infection with one pathogen, and that tends to weaken your immune system, and it opens up the door for a second type of infection to happen. What I study is flu virus. So you get infected with the flu, you feel crummy, kind of weakens your immune system, and it opens the door for a bacteria or a fungus, some other pathogen to come in that you might not normally get otherwise. And I've looked at bacteria causing those second infections, or currently we're looking at how a fungus could cause that second infection.
So most people, they think to themselves, well, of course, I get weaker and I get sicker. And the usual model, I think, for most people is go to the doctor says it's a virus, go home. You go home. Maybe you get worse. If you get worse, you go back, and perhaps they prescribe antibiotics on the off chance that it has now picked up some bacterial infection, and they judge it by something like maybe even the color of your phlegm, I have found.
Right.
So now you're saying that you could also conceivably pick up something that's not bacterial, in which case you'd get sick, but you can't take antibiotics to treat that. Is that right? So what would you do then?
There are antifungal medications that can be used. What doctors have found is they tend not to work very well in this setting. It could be that your immune system is just so weakened at that point that the fact that you're now taking this antifungal drug just isn't enough. Part of the problem, though, is there's so little that we do know. We don't even know how common this is because, frankly, doctors don't usually test for a fungal infection. They think it's either viral or bacterial. Fungal infections are thought to be fairly rare. So we need to know how common this really is. If you read scientific papers, there's maybe 50 instances of a fungal co-infection reported during a flu infection. Is that just because it really is that rare, or is it because we're just not looking for it and so we're missing all of this?
Now, I mean, one of the things you think about with bacteria is they're around all the time. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of times people think, oh, no, I got exposed to a particularly obnoxious strain of bacteria. When in cases, most cases, I think, bacteria on our skin all the time, they're around us all the time. So are the fungal things around us, are the fungi around us all the time then? Is that something we're constantly being exposed to?
Yeah, actually, you probably breathe in about 10,000 fungal spores every day. So in a healthy person, it's usually not an issue. Your body takes care of it. Your immune system, those white blood cells, will remove them from your body. And so it really is the fact that you've got this weakened immune system because of the flu that then allows these fungal spores to get in and actually do something.
Now, you mentioned something about your immune system and the resiliency that it has, but that there may be some sort of a window of opportunity. Mm-hmm. So talk about that a little bit.
The experiments that we've done so far is just trying to develop this model. And one of the first things we did is we infected animals 3, 5, or 7 days after they got the flu. And only on day 3 did they really get more sick. So if you waited to day 5 or day 7, the fungus didn't really seem to do anything. So there's this narrow window where you could potentially be exposed to a fungus while having the flu 3 days later. And otherwise, it's probably not that big of a deal.
And so how would you work with doctors? I mean, I know that you actually worked at St. Jude for a while. So talk about what kinds of things have to be done to actually take this to the next level and sort of do something with it.
So we need to understand why it's happening, and that's really the basic research we're doing right now. The doctors really come into play. We need to know how common is this. We need to know, is it 1 in 10 people who get the flu get the fungal infection? But then maybe only 1 in 100 actually get a severe fungal infection. And so maybe it's not that big of a deal. And what we need are patient samples. And so we have been trying to collaborate with doctors at St. Jude or other locations who can just get us those patient samples so that we can test them and see how many of these patients actually had a fungal co-infection with the flu versus a bacterial versus just the flu by itself.
Right. Right. Now, how do they – so these are people that have taken samples and kept them sterile since then so that they're not constantly being exposed to other things.
Right. They usually take the samples, a nasal swab, and then they'll put it in a freezer, and then they'll just store it until someone comes up with an idea.
Right. Well, very interesting. What were your plans – next plans? I mean, you've got this kind of a co-infection thing going on. And just mention briefly some of the other projects you're working on.
Some of our research is just basic, how does the immune system work? We've been studying the immune system for about 80 years now, and yet we still are finding new proteins, new functions for cells all the time. So I have several students in my lab that are just trying to understand how certain proteins in the immune system function. I also have students who are working in collaboration with other researchers here at Missouri State at other types of diseases. So Dr. Tomasi in the biology department and I are working on a fungal infection in bats. So bats here in the eastern United States and the Ozarks get something called white nose syndrome. And some bats die, some bats live. We want to understand what's the difference. Why are some bats not really dying from it? Is it their immune response? Do they just ignore it? What's up?
Right. Right. So sounds like a broad degree of work going on. Thanks so much for stopping by, Christopher, and I appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
So once again, this is Dave Cornelson for STEM Spots signing off.
STEM Spots is available online at ksmu.org.